good. So, we have only a short time left before we give a few words for the ending of the retreat, and also we do the loving kindness meditation, and then we do the photographs. I think outside is beautiful outside.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I took the opportunity, because I had 15 minutes, just to sit on the stupas. And I can only do that the last 15 minutes ago because I knew all of you were in here. At least you were supposed to be. So I could have some peace and quiet. And it's such a beautiful, quiet place. Even though, of course, I've been here longer than any of you. Even just before the retreat center was built. Just coming over here, walking over here, finding some nice and peace and quiet over here. And one of the stories I always remember about this place, many years before the retreat center was even thought about, one of our Anagarikas, actually I saw him just a few days ago, he just was visiting from Melbourne. One of our Anagarikas decided to go into this property, and he was just spending a nice few hours meditating on the western side of this property. Some beautiful places over here. And when he was meditating there, nice and still, he was wearing white, bald head. We used to have quite a few emus would come over to this part of the forest. Ever since we built the retreat center, they tend to be extremely shy, so I think they've gone further into the bush. They used to come here, and if you've ever seen a wild emu, they would always be sort of very scared. They'd run around very fast, huge bodies, big, tall neck, and they were very fast. It's the only way they could be safe. But anyway, when they saw this Anagarika, the Anagarika was sitting there really quietly. And so these emus, this is what he said, he had his eyes open. One of these emus was looking at him, "What is this?" I'd never seen sort of a person in white sitting so incredibly still. And so it came right up to him, just walking slowly, and put down its beak to sniff him. He said, "I'd like to kiss him." I don't know if you've ever been kissed by an emu. But that's what it was like. And he was just quiet all the time, his eyes were open, giving loving kindness, and the emu just, there's nothing there to eat, nothing to be afraid of, just put his head back and then just wandered off. It's such a lovely thing when you see animals like that, wild animals, and they're not at all afraid, and which is very strange for an emu, and to see them just seeing a nice, calm Anagarika and just going about his own business. Anagarika enjoyed watching the emu, and obviously the emu was quite fascinated seeing a human being who wasn't dangerous and never made him scared. So sometimes when you do find peace in a place like this, when you're peaceful, you find you get much closer to nature and you can enjoy it much more. Animals, birds and stuff, and even snakes are not around now, don't have to worry. All of these animals, they feel almost like connected to you. And I'm just, as I usually do, just go on association from one story to another. It always reminded me of this monk many years ago in one of the jungle monasteries in Thailand. He's living there by himself in a little hut. In the middle of the night, late at night, he heard somebody knocking on his door. There was no other sort of being or human being around. The village was quite a ways away. And when he opened the door, this is quite a sad story, but a real story. When he opened the door, there was a monkey outside with a baby holding it in his hands. And this was like a mother. And the baby was lifeless. And so I don't know how the monkey knew how to knock on the door. But anyway, the mother just handed it to the monk, hoping that the monk would somehow bring her baby back to life. And the monk didn't know too much about medicine, but knew that baby monkey must have died. And so the mother monkey was not scared at all, but just was really sad, almost like pleading, please do something. And all the monk could do, you know, sometimes all I do, is just give some chanting. And then handed the baby back to the mother, and the mother turned around, sad, and walked away. But not afraid at all. And like a connection between wild animals and human beings when they trust you. It's something quite sweet. At least it's very rare than a baby monkey who just passed away and a mother who was grieving for her lost one could receive some chanting from a good monk. It was something. So I love stories like that. And when we see sort of the how animals behave in a forest, can we sit closely and they're not afraid of us. It's actually quite fascinating to watch. One of those other stories, he was an ex-monk, but he needed a little bit of funds to get started back in life. So we gave him a job as doing some landscaping around our monastery. So he'd come in every morning and do some landscaping, clearing the fire breaks. He worked very hard, at his own pace. And he told us one morning, as he came down Southwest Highway and turned into Kingsbury Drive, he saw there was a dead parrot by the side of the road. He'd been hit by a car. Now, unfortunately, that's quite common. But what he didn't expect, he saw on a tree, on a branch of a tree, just on that corner, there was another parrot, which is standing up there staring at the deceased parrot. And then when he finished his work that evening, he was really surprised. The dead parrot was still there. So was the other parrot, staring. When he came back the next morning, the scene hadn't changed. For 3 days, that deceased parrot was being watched over by, obviously, his partner, or her partner, I don't know what the gender was. But they just didn't move at all, just looking down for 3 days. And sometimes we think animals are somehow different than human beings, but when we see just how similar they are, and just how that after a while we can care for one another and trust one another, however we can, without interfering too much. The kangaroos at Bodhinyana Monastery, they're quite used to having their photographs taken, just like me. So a lot of times, as long as they don't get too noisy, and then they feel quite happy just sitting there. I know you're not supposed to feed them anything, it's bad for their health, but the kangaroos don't know that. And I can still remember the scene. It was one kangaroo, and we had a lot of spaghetti left over. So they put it out in the pile there to be composted later on. But as they put it out there, one of the kangaroos had a sniff at it. It was really nice spaghetti. I forget what the sauce was. So the kangaroo tried to eat it. I remember the first time I tried eating spaghetti. What do you do with it? It's not like eating like a piece of bread or something. It's no long. And this kangaroo, I wish I would have had a camera, because the kangaroo has quite a pointy mouth, and the strands of spaghetti were on either side of its mouth, and it was looking at me, and I didn't need to have psychic powers to read its mind. What it was saying was, help. So some of the things you see in nature are just absolutely beautiful. And I'm not sure if I did tell you that I told, I think, in Hong Kong when I was teaching a retreat there just recently, that in the hot weather in Thailand, sometimes the water is very hard to find. And because, you know, in monks we have pipes and we have water coming from somewhere. So I do remember in the same monastery where that big cave was, during the hot season, I'd always leave some water out for the birds in the afternoon. And these were simple huts which we lived in when I wasn't, you know, visiting the cave. just like boards, wooden boards. And of course, all those wooden boards, they weren't sort of fancy. Some of them had knot holes in. And I remember just coming out of meditation, and I'd already put the water out there earlier. I looked through the knot hole to see the birds coming to drink the water and to have a bathe, which they would do every afternoon. When I was looking, there was something I never suspected I'd ever see. This was in north of Thailand, up in the mountains. Thai culture. I never expected to see all these birds, many different species, certainly different genders, lining up in a queue. One after the other. It's crazy. And they would be very disciplined. The one in the bowl would just drink and just wash his wings and get sort of nice and cool. And then when they had finished, that one would fly away and another one would come in and bathe. They were just, they organized themselves, so many different species of birds in a queue. And I thought, wow, who are the intelligent ones? Human beings or these birds? But of course, there was always one bird, not the same bird, but a bird would come in the afternoon and they would jump the queue. They were not going to wait for these other ones. And they'd jump in the water. And all the other birds who were queuing up would get out of line and jump on that bird, peck him, and chase him away. All together, gang up on him. But then afterwards, they'd all go back in line again. Exactly as they were before they had this interloper, queue jumper. And I thought that was really quite sweet. And I don't know even how they remembered which, but I took a note of that, and just, they were all in the same position as beforehand. So they're very, very well disciplined and kind, and so it's wonderful to see animals in the wild like that. And I don't know if you've seen that kookaburra on the railings there. That's been here for years. That's what happens when people learn how to do jhanas. They sit so perfectly still. That's really, obviously, I don't know where they got that from. It's supposed to scare away other birds who shouldn't be actually going in there and just eating up all the grass. But anyway, it's a very pleasant place. And I hope you've enjoyed it while you've been here. Not just in here or in the huts, but just in the outside. It was a bit of rain, and some people think it's cold. But one of the tricks, which I didn't really have the time to tell you, but often, just in the evening, if it's been a reasonably dry day, it may be cool in the evening, but if you just meditate on the stupa, on the platform around it, those stones, they actually soak up the heat from the day. So it may be cold outside or on the air, but you sit on those stones and it has its own warmth. And because of that, sometimes people have been smart enough, and I say smart enough, to lie down on their backs. And it's very comfortable. And when you're lying on your back, the wind may be blowing, it may be cool, it's in the middle of the night, but nevertheless it's like you've got an electric blanket underneath you. It's warm. And you can open your eyes and look at the stars at night. And it's a beautiful thing to see these stars in Australia. I don't know how many years you've, and some of you Australians, lived in Australia, but to be able to lie on your back and see the Milky Way, see all these stars up there and just how gorgeous they are. That's one of the reasons why you find in a place like this is so many opportunities to have a lot of happiness and bliss. Who needs a TV when you've got the whole Milky Way above you just to watch? Who needs Nature Channel when you've got what those photographers of Nature Channel come to look at, to take those photographs? You've got it real. And all the animals over here. Now those animals, They don't harm anybody. They've never harmed anybody here. So sometimes you just look at them and you're kind to them. They go around their business, you go with your business, and we have this wonderful like harmony together. And that's how I was taught as a monk. And so sometimes people think this is weird, but it's true. In the hot weather in Thailand, you know, there's all sorts of animals in that forest. And the spiders, there's tarantulas in that part of town. They would live up in the roof. But there's no sort of ceiling there, just open rafters and then the tin roof. And sometimes in the hot weather, they would lose their footing and they would fall onto the floor. Or if I was laying on the floor, they'd fall on me. And because it was hot weather, I just had a lower robe on, but from the chest up to the head, it was all bare. It was cooling off inside my heart. So they'd fall on your chest. And actually, I really liked that. Because these were quite big spiders. They would never, ever bite you. They'd go... and they're really kind of tickly and cute. And because I was never afraid of them, of course they would never bite me or sting me or anything. It was just I loved them. They were my friends. And when you see animals like that and you make friends with them, the whole experience of being in a forest, being in nature, is totally different. You're not at all scared. You're just another wild animal amongst the other wild animals. And you know, you have your place and you respect everybody else in that forest. But I must admit, I wasn't expected to talk about this. But nevertheless, in that same monastery up in the north, I'm an honest monk, that one day when I was meditating there, inside the hut this time, you know, that sometimes you're sensitive enough to know that something weird is happening. Like electricity in the air, sometimes people say. But suddenly something was up. So I went outside my hut. There were some mountains there. There was a huge expanse of sky. And it was a clear day. And when I looked in the sky, and you've ever seen like birds migrating, there's a whole flock of birds, and they're really densely packed. Imagine that that scene was actually for the whole of that sky. Millions of birds were out there in the sky. Unbelievable. And I wondered, you could hear them all chirping, not the same species, all types of different species of birds. And I wondered, what the heck is going on? And when I saw it, as every inch of the sky was all full of birds. Now, it was in forest, jungles, and I saw that there was two big birds there. I'd never seen a bird like that before in real life. Beforehand, the only big wild bird I ever saw was what's called a king's eagle. And that was over in Norway. When I was trekking in Norway, I came over a ridge in some mountains, and there was this huge bird. It was sitting. It wasn't sort of flying, it was just kind of squatting. But even so, as it was squatting, it was about the size of you. So it's huge. And it was looking at me. And I got scared. I thought, no, this is the bird's territory, not mine. And it was looking. And if it wanted to attack me, I would have no defense. That was just the torso of it. If it stood up and spread its wings, it would be huge. I just turned around and quietly walked away. And so I was safe. But these birds were even bigger. And there was two of them. It was a pair. Never seen anything like it in my life. And it looked as if, my conclusion at the time, well, these were like some king and queen of the birds in this forest. And all the other birds were up there in the air, you know, kind of paying respect. And later on, you know, that a lot of the mythology of Buddhism kind of don't believe in, if you're a Westerner, especially if you're a theoretical physicist before. But when you see these things with your own eyes, it's kind of wonder. Now, was that a couple of Garudas? Because afterwards, that's what I kind of thought. These were these mythical birds. Maybe some of them did exist. And these are the sorts of places I was always told you'll see such things. And up in the mountains, in a remote area, jungle, and this was actually close to the border between Thailand and Myanmar, Burma. It was only a short walk to the border. And so those are the sorts of areas where you see some strange things. When you see it with your own eyes, what is that? Of course, you know, as a monk you don't have cameras. So because of that, I couldn't take any photograph. It just were in awe at some of the interesting things which happened in the forest. Anyway, that's not what I'm supposed to be talking about. I'm supposed to be talking about, this is the retreats are going to be finishing soon. But you don't have to worry or exaggerate the fact a retreat is finished, because there's always another one soon, somewhere in the world. And that's one of the reasons why. I mean, my next one, next retreat, where is it? That's here, but there's also others overseas or over in Thailand in June, over somewhere else in May. Over in Colombo, in Bandaruela in May. I think that's the next one. There's always retreats going on somewhere. So you don't have to worry, say, oh my goodness, it's all over, what am I going to do now? You'd always find there's another retreat, but there's also something I would add for your benefit. That this place, one of the reasons why we brought our own retreat centre, of course it was expensive, a lot of work, and that's amazing just how people look after it so beautifully well. It's 14 years old and it's just so clean and comfortable and welcoming. I know that somebody, as our president at the time, she thought, well, look, this is like a hotel. You should treat it like a hotel, charge people, and have all these staff working here. And I really rebelled against that. I said, no. You know, this is for human beings, for your friends. It's like the guest block of a monastery. Everyone is welcome. And not just wealthy people, but just, you know, people with little money. That's one of the reasons why. Sometimes I get into trouble with this, but if you are poor, really poor, you know, you can, on that departure form, always ask for your room bond to be returned. But if you can afford it, you know, just please use it as a donation. It keeps this place comfortable. And it doesn't go to me or anybody. Even, you see how hard Robin has been working? Does she get any pay? No. Everybody here all does it out of kindness. It's their merit making. So please be generous if you can, but if you can't, come anyway. You can get the money back. And that's kind of beautiful. When people ask, you know, how much does it cost to come and stay here? You know what I say? I never say it's free. It's priceless. Because I like the word priceless. It means, how can you put a fee on staying in a beautiful place like this? If you did put a fee on it, none of you would be able to afford it. It's like priceless. It's kindness. It's generosity. It's opening the door of your heart to everybody. And so that's why we like it here. It's not really Buddhist. And of course, you know, what you get out of this is absolutely huge. So often it does change your life. It's not just the meditation. It's the hall. I never actually said about this bamboo floor here. I always get inspired by this. When we were building this, I asked the builder many times, when's it going to be finished? I said, oh, maybe by February or something. And of course, I have enough experience to know, if I say February, maybe June. But then the person who was in charge of scheduling everything said, she remember she came up to me and said, are you doubting my professional capability? She was quite intimidating. And I said, okay, we'll make it for the Easter holidays, in April. I said, yeah, easy. And of course, this is the first retreat starting on Good Friday. on Thursday. Of course it wasn't finished. The big thing which was left was the flooring on this part of the meditation room. We couldn't get a carpenter or floor layer to finish this. That half was finished, but not this half. We tried our best. It was in the afternoon. And of course, what do workers want to do that time? They want to sort of stop working for the weekend and have a nice, quiet, relaxing time over Easter. We couldn't get any workers to finish this. And you know who the patron is of this? That was Dr. Jeff Gallup. You know, he was a premier just before, and we asked him, because we helped him with his depression, and he said, "Will you be our patron?" He said, "Yes." So he was coming to open Jhana Grove, Dr. Jeff Gallup. It was a bit of a shame that he got depression, because he was one of the most popular premiers of Western Australia ever, and we got to know him very well. And I was thinking at the time, you know, Dr. Gallup, he was a best friend at the time. I mean, he really was a best friend of Tony Blair, who was then the Prime Minister of UK. And even Jeff Gallup was the best man at Tony Blair and Cheryl's wedding. And so I started to fantasize, a monk fantasy. I said, "Well, I've got Jeff Gallup already. Now it won't be a short matter of time before he'd introduce me to Tony Blair, then I can convert Tony Blair to being a Buddhist." And Tony Blair was very close to George Bush. So once I had Tony Blair and George Bush, you could change the whole world. But then, of course, he got depression and so couldn't do anything. Anyway, all of those fantasies, again, they don't work out usually. But nevertheless, you know who finished this floor? It was the monks. I told them, "Look, now that we're opening tomorrow, we've got really big VIPs coming tomorrow, there's no floor." And so the monks worked all night. I think they finished about 4 o'clock in the morning. I think Ajahn Mamada was involved, about the main instigator of the all-night finishing of this room was Ajahn Santuti. He was brilliant. And they, of course, they don't get paid, and they had to do the ceremony the following day. But nevertheless, they said, "Yeah, we'll do this." They did such a wonderful job. So I know that sometimes you think you do dana for monks. Monks do dana for you. While you're sitting over on this side over here, that was all done by monks overnight the day before. To me, like, that sort of stuff is priceless. It's inspiring. And that's, I wouldn't have had it any other way. If I could have planned it, I'd have planned it like that. So this, I'm not a sadist, it's just inspiration. So those sorts of things are how this place was run. And so what you're learning here is not just how to meditate, it's how to be inspired, how to just do things in a totally different way than you expected. And that means that this place will last such a long time. Once we start to organize it and start having roles and paying people, then I think it'll all go pear-shaped. As long as we keep it the way it's always been, volunteers, kindness, people coming here and doing their best and feeling the beauty. We don't pay the kangaroos to come and visit here. We don't pay the red-tailed cockatoos to come and fly over so Nicholas can take photographs of them. All these animals and the animals you hear, they're all part of this nature, and you're part of the nature too. And they get used to this, you get used to this. And it gives you this wonderful sense of peace and harmony together. And that is one of the reasons why this place works. Different to other places. It's like you're a monk or a nun, a forest monk, a forest nun. They're living for 9 days in quiet places, enjoying a lifestyle just as a monk or nun would enjoy it. You know, people bring you the food, you help in however you can, and you have all this beautiful place to sit quietly, to walk quietly, to exercise, to wash up the dishes afterwards. It's all just a beautiful part of being peaceful and being kind and being gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. So I hope you've learnt a lot on this retreat. And if you think, oh, I haven't got jhanas, I haven't got nibbana, oh, go, my young. As long as you've got some peace and happiness, the smile on your face has got a little bit bigger, and it's coming from a much more pure, reliable place, then that's more than enough. That be content and easily satisfied is an important part of the path. So the Eightfold Path, yes. But that's the second factor of the Eightfold Path. And to me, it's one of the crucial factors of the Eightfold Path. If you're content, if you're making peace, being content, easily satisfied, from there all your precepts come. And it's just common sense to keep your precepts. It's very common sense, because who wants to hurt another being or hurt yourself? It doesn't make any sense. Remember, even with children, sometimes you used to have these kids' groups coming. And can you teach them Buddhism? How do you teach them Buddhism? So I asked them, just precepts is not doing anything which hurts others or hurts yourself. Give me some examples. And even these 6 or 7 year old kids, they soon got the 5 precepts. That's one way of not harming other people or harming oneself. Even one time I just gave this stop at your moment, 5 minutes. I didn't talk too much. But one day, there was one of the school teachers who was in Roldestone High School. And it was a very strong Christian area up there years ago. But she used to come to our meditation group. And, you know, because she was really fascinated with the meditation, she asked if she could teach meditation to the kids. It was year sixes in Roldestone Grammar School. And it was wonderful. This was maybe 30 years ago. You know, it's quite common to teach meditation in schools these days, but this was, you know, way ahead of her time. And she never called it meditation, she called it quiet time. Starting at 5 or 10 minutes in the beginning of the year, and building up stage by stage to about 15 minutes at the beginning of the day. And once some of the parents figured out that she was teaching them meditation, they complained to the principal. And the principal, who was a strong Christian, defended her to the max. She said, I've seen this. I've seen what it does to the kids. The effects are amazing. The kids have so much more harmony, sensitivity to one another, and their performance in all their subjects goes up. I said, I will defend this to the max against the other parents. So she did that for years and did a wonderful job. She said interesting things, that sometimes in a community, this was just a class, that sometimes there was arguments. Somebody pinched something or somebody said something rude or something. And he said, when that happened, there's always somebody in the class, when the people were going to get angry, and maybe an argument in the classroom, someone will put up their hand and say, Miss, can we have quiet time now, please? And that's what they did. They stopped whatever they were doing. Everyone would sit down quietly for 5 or 10 minutes. And at the end of that, the class was in harmony again. It's beautiful. But anyway, because the school respected me, they asked me to go and to teach one morning. So I went there to teach, But they never told me that this was not year sixes. This was year one and year two. How can you teach such little bubs, you know, dependent origination or four noble truths? It was easy. So there's two classes there, and the parents went along because they were a bit suspicious of me. And so I began, announced who I was, and then I asked them a question. I said, how many of you, it's about 60 kids, how many of you have ever eaten rice pudding? You know what rice pudding is? It's just rice and milk and sugar. They bake it. How many of you have ever eaten rice pudding? I thought, no, sorry, I got that question wrong. How many of you like rice pudding? And about three kids put their hand up. I said, okay, put your hands down. How many of you don't like rice pudding? Another two or three kids put their hand up. They didn't like rice pudding. I see, I've got this story all the way wrong way round. I'll start it off again. Please forget what you've just heard. Here. I asked the kids, 60 kids, how many of you do not like eating rice pudding? About two or three kids put a hand up straight away. Now, if you ever know the psychology of year one and year two, all the other kids looked around and they saw these three kids with their hand up, so they put their hand up as well. And one by one, soon after about 2 or 3 minutes, had the whole 60 kids all in agreement they did not like eating rice pudding. Okay, put your hands down, very good. Now, how many of you have ever eaten rice pudding? And about 4 or 5 kids put their hand up, that's all. And everybody burst out laughing, even the kids. And the parents were giggling as well. You got the message. Why is it we say we can't do meditation? You haven't done it yet. It's just a matter of time. You've done thinking. You've done wondering. You've done wishing you can meditate. That's why sometimes you can see what Dharma really is. How we just project onto the world and we expect those projections to be accurate. And so the idea of being rebellious is just don't trust those projections. It's amazing, just the wonderful things which you can experience in life. Real. Why are you going so fast, clock? Yeah, I've got to do some better meditation, but last story, I promise. Maybe. You know, we do. The reason I've got to finish and go into town this afternoon, because we have our New Year's, Thai New Year, Southeast Asian New Year ceremony on Sunday. I have to prepare for that. But we sometimes do these ceremonies, and how many of you were here 20 years ago when we did our 30th anniversary of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia? Oh, Premier, you were here, yeah. And Nicholas, anyone else was here at that time? Oh, you were here, J2C. It was weird. Full moon day, Waisak in May. And again, we'd invited all these dignitaries, including Jeff Gallup. That's where he really got some faith in us. And I'll tell you why. Because that morning, I looked at the news. It was an open-air ceremony in this most prestigious location in Perth, Supreme Court Gardens. A nice field right in the centre of Perth. And we arranged everything, and I looked at the forecasts. Severe weather warning. A big storm was going to hit Perth, CBD, timing 7 p.m. Our ceremony was going to start at 7 p.m. But one of the wonderful things you learn about being a monk, just go for it. There's other things that play other than weather and other than science. So we went anyway. It was raining all day. From the time we left early in the morning till we were in Supreme Court Gardens setting things up. And all those who were there then, you've got to really give them credit. They were all getting soaked. Me too. But then we kept on going. The weather forecasts got worse and worse and worse. And so a number of people. I remember your partner, before ex-partner, who was a monk at the time, he took me aside. Ajahn Brahma, I respect you, but you're making me embarrassed. There's a storm coming. Cancel, please. No. This other guy who was a merchant seaman, he's passed away now, he also took me aside. Ajahn Brahm, look, I know these things. You know, the storms, the weather, that means I can survive at sea or whatever, but the storms can kill us. There is a big storm coming. You can't do this. Cancel it. No. 3 times. The Premier's office called. They gave me the mobile phone. There's a Premier's office there. Are you cancelling? I said no. Like up an hour later. Are you cancelling? No. I'm not making this up. 3rd time. Are you cancelling? No. And the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful things was about 30 minutes before the ceremony was to start. It had been pouring down. Pouring and pouring, so wet. And I was in one of the tents helping somebody else. And then this lady, Cherry's mother, Shirley Jackson, she came into the tent and she was crying. Jabab, come outside now. And straight away I thought, oh, what else could go wrong? Is someone broken their leg or electrocuted themselves? What other tragedy am I going to deal with? So we went outside the tent. It had stopped raining. And she pointed up into the sky, the full moon. You could see the full moon over the Supreme Court Gardens. There was no clouds at all. It was like an island of no rain and a beautiful full moon. Half an hour later, the Premier came and we did the ceremony. We had one TV crew coming, and the lady that's supposed to be interviewing people, she just was going around saying, "This is weird. This is weird. This is weird." We did our ceremony, and after it was finished, the rains bucketed down really hard. And the Supreme Court Gardens, those of you who know, was under a couple of inches of water. It was flooded. The freeway was flooded. It was a very heavy rainstorm. But we had this couple of hours where we held our ceremony, and we could. And afterwards, the guy who had organized, who ran the company, who hired out the tents and the electricity and the stage and everything else, he sent this wonderful email to one of our people who was liaising with them. He said, "I've never heard of this Ajahn Brahm before. I don't care who he is, but can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing today?" That was a compliment. How on earth can that happen? That really was a miracle. That really was heavenly beings helping us out. And I must admit that before I left Bodhinyana to go come here in the morning, I did some really heavy chanting for those heavenly beings. Come on, this is important for us. It's not just for us. It's for, you know, the Buddhism Dharma in Western Australia. We need some help. Please come and help. And they did. It's wonderful when those sorts of things happen. That's kind of inspirational. And that's the sort of thing which is wonderful along. If you're actually there at the time, it really means much more to you. If I just say, oh, here we go again, these crazy monks, crazy religious people, you know, praise the Lord or praise the Buddha, or sometimes you get a bit fed up with that, but this was real and it meant so much and many people saw it. So that's one of the reasons why at one of these retreats you can sometimes figure out why these things happen. There's more to life, and I say this as a theoretical physicist, than science. So, it's now 9 o'clock, I have to finish now.